Corbin Middlemass here. The Ashes were awesome, but they are over. The good news is the cricket keeps rolling as the focus shifts to the T20 World Cup. Australia is trying to climb back to the top, India is looking all powerful, and England is trying to turn Ashes shame into T20 glory. And did we mention the backroom power struggles? The ABC Cricket Podcast is dropping every Monday and Friday as former opener Ed Cowan joins me to pull apart the juiciest storylines in the game. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Eamon Evans is a Melbourne-based writer and philosopher, and he's here to tell you something that you might not want to hear about happiness. Eamon says that the relentless pursuit of happiness is as pointless as nailing jelly to a wall. And he says the idea that we have a right to happiness is historically quite strange and emotionally counterproductive. He says, when we keep trying to climb Happiness Mountain, it's only going to make us more miserable. And yet, the world keeps telling us that sadness is the enemy, and if you're feeling down, it's because you've got some kind of a problem. If you're not constantly happy and positive and committed, then something's wrong with you. It's better, Eamon says, to accept struggle and sadness as normal, as part of a meaningful human life. And so he's here to speak up for the blessings of misery. Misery, he says, builds character, makes you more interesting and kinder. He's written a book and it's called The Importance of Being Miserable. Hello, Eamon.
Hello, Richard. How are you doing? I'm happy to be here.
I am happy too. But this fleeting, evanescent thing called happiness has glimmered in front of me. It'll disappear momentarily, but it'll come back in fits and starts during the course of this conversation. What made you think about happiness and misery in this way? Was there a specific moment you could think of, Eamon?
I mean, the deep answer to that question, I guess, is that I was kind of quite depressed and down for a little while in my early 20s, and I was been pretty jolly fellow up until that point, but I feel like I was viewing life through quite a small and narrow lens. And when things began to go wrong and I began to feel awful in all sorts of ways, I could still see the same things through that little lens, but I could also see other things that were making me sad. And when I did eventually wade through the muck and find myself moderately well adjusted, I was basically left with a bigger lens through which to view life. I was seeing more things to appreciate and I was more appreciative of them. And so I think that misery is a vital thread in the tapestry of life. We tend to see it as the enemy of happiness, but I think it's actually the thing that makes happiness possible.
What were some of these other things you could see in this broader lens?
I think you just stop taking for granted things that you otherwise would. When you know what it is to feel low, you truly appreciate what it is to feel high. Like, to spend all day on a couch and then sort of hop into bed is, it's not uncomfortable, but it's not exactly a cherishable, wonderful moment. Whereas to trudge around in the cold and the wind up a mountain all day and then hop into a nice warm bed, that is a moment of glorious comfort. Contrast, I think, is the engine of emotion. All emotions thrive on their opposite. You can only really feel hot because you've felt cold. You can only see light because you've seen dark. And equally, just as mountains require valleys, I think highs require lows. And having those lows in my 20s and from time to time ever since, I think makes me much more appreciative of those moments when life is going well. At bottom, we all agree that it's something worth pursuing. At bottom, we all agree that life is too short to be miserable. We wish each other happy new year. We have happy meals. We drink at happy hours. We smile for photos. We wish each other a good day. If someone asks you how you are, what you want to be able to say is that you're doing well. It sounds logical, but is it? Because you actually need to be down a bit from time to time. Like, constant wellness would not be well. Constant joy would not be joyful. Constant fun would not be fun. Constant contentment would not be contentment. Life would just be a sort of a grey blur. So I think we need to reprogram ourselves to accept that constant permanent happiness can never be our lot in life, and to enjoy or at least accept the moments when we're not feeling it.
Recently, my colleague Sarah Konoski interviewed addiction and trauma specialist Gabor Mate, and he says something really interesting in his book. He says, what the system sells as happiness is actually pleasure. the philosophical and economic distinction that makes all the difference between profit or loss. Pleasure is, this feels good, I want more. And happiness, on the other hand, is, this feels good, I am contented, I am complete. And this tracks perfectly, he said, with his understanding of addictions and brain chemistry. I think there's a difference that has to be drawn here, doesn't there, between contentment and pleasure within the universe of happiness.
I would doubt that constant contentment is possible. I feel constant contentment requires occasional discontent. Imagine a movie where everyone starts out content and happy and healthy and wealthy and wise, and then they remain happy and content in Act Two, and then the movie ends up with everyone being happy and content. Would you, as a viewer, be content with that movie, or would you be slightly bored?
Yeah, I'm not watching that, no.
Yeah, we want our life to be something of a roller coaster. It's better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a pig satisfied, as John Stuart Mill put it. You're better off sort of worrying away about X, Y, Z and fretting away about A, B, C than you are just sort of quietly chewing the grass and staring vacantly at a fence.
One of the things you want to do away with pretty quickly is the idea that people were happier in the good old days than they are now. And this really brought to mind, my son said to me recently, he said, he and other Gen Zers are watching Friends and they look back at the 90s as this golden age when people were happier. And I went, man, you got no idea how dark the culture was. It wasn't so much Friends, it was more like Nirvana back in the 90s. And this idea that the 50s was this golden time, really imminent nuclear destruction, constant war, tension, nervousness. This is just not true, that there was somehow this golden age when people were much happier then than they are now.
Yeah, I mean, we're predisposed to think that back in the day, the sun was sunnier, the grass was greener, the politicians were nobler, the communities were kinder, music had more soul. But if you actually trudge throughout history from sort of ancient Rome onwards, you'll find people complaining about the youth of today, people saying that migrants are taking jobs and causing crimes, that the family unit is disintegrating, that love is dead, that government is corrupt, that commerce is inefficient. I think memory is not a documentary. It's a movie with sort of special effects and careful editing where all the actors are wearing makeup. I think the bottom line is that there's never really been a moment where people live in the moment. We're designed to be anxious. We're designed to worry about what comes next. When we look in the past, it's easy to pretend that people were shaking each other by the hand and saying, hey, we've done it. Society is perfect. We can all kick back and smell those roses. But in fact, that's not true. People were worrying about stuff just as much, if not a great deal more than we are today.
You say that there's some kind of baseline that operates of happiness in our brains that moves up and down relative to the circumstances we're living in. Can you explain how that works in our heads?
We're sort of on an emotional bungee cord. For the first 99% of human history, the meaning of life was to not die. People weren't too worried about feeling good. If they got through the day without coughing up blood or losing a limb or being eaten by a bear, on the whole, they were doing just fine. But the research suggests that once you can take your continued existence for granted, once you've got a roof on your head and a certain amount of money in the bank and a certain amount of food in the cupboard, added wealth, added success or good fortune doesn't really do a lot to change your lot. There's been studies done of people who won Tats Lotto and people who had a terrible accident with the result that they were stuck in a wheelchair for the rest of their life. And obviously the first set were significantly happier over the next 12 months or so. And the second set of people were understandably feeling a lot worse. But after a while, they both more or less got back to where they were beforehand. The bottom line really is that we wildly overestimate the extent to which our feelings are based on our attitudes or our thoughts or our circumstances. We have this assumption that if you find the right job or find the right partner or raise your kids well or travel a lot or have good friends or a sound upbringing, the right sorts of feelings are going to result from that. We have this sort of sense that happiness is within our control, something that we can achieve. And that's not really true. Happiness can be pursued and it can occasionally be caught, but the moment you have caught it, it just slips away. happiness is not designed to be a permanent part of your life. It's an occasional guest, and it's going to come at the least expected moment, and the same goes, I'm afraid, for misery.
I wonder if this is why artists and writers have so much trouble depicting what heaven is like. Dante's Inferno has this great and really detailed description of hell, but heaven's really boring. And artists similarly have trouble exceeding the imagination of clouds and harps and white robes. Nothing much happens, really. I wonder if that's because you kind of need the darkness to give definition to the light.
Absolutely. If you're sailing around the Mediterranean in a yacht for 3 months, after a while you're just a little bit sunburnt and sick of champagne. If your football team wins week in, week out, wins the premiership year in, year out, you're not ecstatic after a few years. You're developing an interest in golf. Things are fun as a result of things being not fun. Things are exciting as a result of things are being boring. Misery or boredom or anxiety or jealousy or regret or whatever it might be are flaws in the machine, signs that things aren't going according to plan. But actually, they're sort of vital cogs in the machine. They're what enabled the happiness machine to work in the first place. Heaven would be a grey and dull place.
My cat knows how to be perfectly happy just lying and basking in the sun. But we're denied that. And I think that's probably because we can remember the past well and we can anticipate what's in the future and it makes us anxious. We're kind of hardwired never to be able to really enjoy a hugely long stretch of contented happiness like my cat.
Yeah, well, dopamine, it's the chemical of wanting. It's not the chemical of having. It drives its craving, pursuit, motivation. And we need that to survive as a species. The bald fact of the matter is that we as humans used to have lots of cousins and other sorts of humanoids, and they've all been wiped out. We are a very select group descended from a select group that managed to survive the famine and the infections and the floods and the fires and the plagues and the snakes and the spiders and the animals. And none of our ancestors were the type to stop and smell the roses. They were the type that only ever looked at a rose bush to make sure it wasn't hiding a wolf. Our ancestors weren't the people who were lying around appreciating the majesty of existence and admiring the sunset. They were the people who were storing food for the winter. They were the people who were migrating to get ahead of the winter. They were people that were always on their guard. So yeah, evolution, nature doesn't want us to be happy. Nature wants us to survive. In evolutionary terms, the moment we're sort of blissfully content with our lot is the moment we accidentally fall off a cliff or get eaten by a bear.
The word happiness is just a word. What are the origins of the word happiness in the English language?
Well, it comes about from this. I mean, God today is sort of like a cross between Santa and a life coach. He wants us to be happy. He wants us to live our best life and achieve all our dreams. But historically, your gods were not like that at all. Your gods were human manifestations of nature. They were explanations for why the world was such a terrible place. They were fire gods. They were famine gods. They were thunder gods. And that's sort of built into the language because it didn't occur to our ancestors that the universe should cater to their emotional needs. They were trying to survive. And if by some sort of cosmic accident or stroke of luck, they felt good for a time, then it was nothing more than that. It was luck. And yeah, that is buried in the language. Happiness comes from perhaps, happenstance, mishap. It is not something you generate for yourself. It is a thing that happens to you. In German, the word for happiness is Glück, which, yes, means luck. In French, it's Heureux or something, which basically means fortunate. And in Latinate languages, your French, your Spanish, your Portuguese, your Italian, it's all felicidad, felicito, which basically means felicity, blessed,
luck, lucky. Again, luck. Yeah. So happiness is kind of embedded in the language, in European languages anyway, comes from this idea that it's like luck. It's a gift of the gods and the gods can take away as well as give.
And what the gods give you, the gods can take away. Whereas in modern culture, it's the exact reverse of that. Happiness is like a self-help project.
You go out and get it. That's right.
Happiness is something that you can achieve yourself either by getting the right job and so on, or in its most extreme form in your self-help books. You've got your 8 steps and your 10 rules and your 4 pillars and your 12 secrets and your programs and your courses and your webinars and your candles. But whether or not we've all swallowed that particular brand of Kool-Aid.
So the moment you said webinar, my spirits just sank.
I know.
I just collapsed then all of a sudden. I had to G myself up again after that. The word webinar is designed to make people depressed, I would say.
Well, you'll feel happy when it's over, though. That's the one good thing.
So you need the webinar. You need webinars in this life.
Yes, that's right.
As a measuring stick to the Sid Vicious theory, the reason why he used to bang his head against a wall because it felt good when he stopped.
Yeah.
So if we need the webinars in our lives so we feel good when it stops, in other words.
They take away the sting of death.
So there's this view in the ancient world that happiness is like luck. It lies entirely in the gift of the gods. So how does the idea of human agency come into it then? The idea that humans can make their own luck or happiness?
Well, it ever so slowly kicks off in what is sometimes called the Axial Age, which is about sort of 500 BC. You've got this very, very brief period of history, about 100 years, where all of these intellectual, cultural giants lived at the same time. This is when the Bible was written. This is when Confucius was wandering around. This is when you had Buddha, your Aristotle, your Stoics, your Cynics. And
so this is an age when, around 500 BC, when you've got Confucius walking around, the Buddha walking around, and Aristotle walking around.
Yeah, and all the writers of the Old Testament and so on and so forth. Your architects of Hinduism, though it obviously predated that, did a lot of their work in that time. And it's not really a coincidence that they all existed at the same time, because this is roughly when humans invented farming, in roughly 10,000 BC. And by about 500 BC, we'd kind of got the hang of it. We had a handful of cities where certain inhabitants of them, those who weren't slaves, could be pretty confident that they were going to live a long life. And the question then arose, what is the meaning of it? You know, in Castaway, Tom Hanks never worries about the meaning of life. In The Revenant, Leonardo DiCaprio never worries whether feeling fulfilled and what his inner child is up to.
When he's being mauled by a bear,
correct,
not worried about his KPIs at that point.
No, exactly. No. So, yeah, basically, a certain degree of health and wealth is obviously a blessing, but it can also be a curse, because it gives rise to these questions of, you know, I am alive, therefore what's next? That's when the idea first arose that we had some level of agency over our life. The gods were still in charge, don't get me wrong, but there was some sense that we had a role in the story. We could script some of our own lines. But even then, the idea that we could and should pursue happiness was just not a thing. Those ancient philosophers, they were about virtue, they were about discipline, they were about detachment.
When we get to figures like the Buddha, he was really specific about this stuff, wasn't he? About the pursuit of happiness and desire.
Yeah, desire causes suffering. That happiness, if you want to call it that, is freedom from desire, freedom from craving. And the Stoics were not dissimilar. But to my mind, that's slightly joyless. Like, a Stoic would treat a cancer diagnosis and a birthday cake with pretty much the same expression. It's a philosophy of life that says we should try and endure this thing rather than attempt to enjoy it. Confucius, very much the same. He was all about duty over desire, know your role, follow your rituals, practice discipline. He said something like, he who seeks only pleasure will not be able to avoid destruction, which is not something you find in self-help books today. No. It's not really the American way. So that was the way of things from 500 BC until about 500 AD. And then Roman Empire collapsed and the Catholic Church became the only show in town. And true happiness was reserved for the next world. Life on this one involved ploughing and sowing and getting the plague. And you had your seven deadly sins. Lust, sloth, pride, all the good stuff were very much considered the bad stuff. And your average medieval saint was oftentimes someone who would wear a hair shirt, who would wander around in rags, covered in sores, refusing comfort, sleeping on wood, possibly even whipping themselves. They were actively seeking pain in order to prove their devotion. Jesus died for our sins on the cross, and the general vibe was we should suffer too.
So we go through this period of the Middle Ages where there's a great suspicion of happiness. The point of life isn't happiness. It's more about virtue, really. Virtue and obedience and forbearance of the troubles of this world. And then the printing press comes along and changes everything. How does the printing press change things?
Well, I think the printing press was 1440 or thereabouts. Up until the printing press, the church pretty much had a monopoly on ideas. To own a book was more or less like owning a Ferrari, and being able to read was possibly even rarer. You know, books were handwritten laboriously by monks over a period of years. The printing press was like the invention of the internet multiplied by 12. Suddenly, ideas were allowed to spread around the continent. And one of those ideas was that the church didn't have a monopoly on wisdom, and the church wasn't the only way to access God. People could instead have their own relationship with God. Rather than obeying what your local priest or uncle bishop told you to do, you could obey the dictates of your own conscience. And from that came, obviously, the Reformation, the rise of Protestant churches. And what you had then was the beginning of social mobility. Not long after the Reformation came the Renaissance, and with it, the beginnings of the Enlightenment and what we now call sort of capitalism, rather than to keep you ignorant and downtrodden, sowing and ploughing your Lord's field until you got leprosy or sent off to war. It became in society's interest to motivate you to come up with ideas and an independent thought and achieve things independently for yourself. Capitalism encouraged individualism. Capitalism encouraged consumerism. Capitalism encouraged the idea that your life was not set in stone. You weren't born a serf and then a serf you would remain. There was a social ladder that you could climb. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. That sort of thing became ever more in vogue throughout the 16, 17, 1800s and, yeah, was really turbocharged with the Industrial Revolution.
I think one of the most radical statements to appear at this time is the one that's in the US Declaration of Independence. If you're part of the non-slave population of the Americas, suddenly you're living far better, by and large, than Europeans are. And when the US tries to pursue its independence, Jefferson writes those amazing words, which he says people are endowed with certain rights in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, this is when we get the pursuit of happiness identified as a right. Now, this is meant to imply at the time that governments shouldn't get in the way of an individual's pursuit of happiness. But this is a real break with the thinking of the ancient world, isn't it? And the medieval world. Suddenly, happiness is something that's not the gift of the gods or a god. It's something that we can pursue and grant to ourselves.
Yes. The idea of human agency is really quite a rare one. For a long time, you had the idea that the pleasure was sinful. And then, as a result, I would suggest, of capitalism, it was suddenly in the interests of the powers that be for people to pursue pleasure and to create products and provide services that serve the pleasure of others.
And one of the ideas that is the engine room of capitalism comes from Adam Smith, the Scottish economist, who says that he shows that how the individual pursuit of self-interests improves the commonwealth of a society. It seems now this is a moment when the pursuit of individual happiness becomes not just a right, but like a moral good, a virtuous thing to pursue.
Very much so. Greed did not used to be good. Greed was quite literally one of the seven deadly sins. And yet, for most of human history, people were their roles. You were the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. The role that you were born in was the role that you were to remain in. You were part of the community. You had a role to play in that community. And the last thing you would ever wish to do is let that community down. But suddenly, the idea came along that the best service you could provide to your community was via self-interest. By serving yourself, you were serving the wider world. It's an idea that everyone got on board with quite quickly. Suddenly, instead of wanting you to be miserable, instead of wanting Earth to be a sort of waiting room for heaven, heaven became a place on Earth. Greed became a virtue. And buying things became a virtue. For most of Western history, you bought what you needed, and if something broke, you fixed it. You replaced it only when necessary. Suddenly, it became a desirable thing to buy new things. What you owned became who you were. And moving up in society, rising through the ranks, becoming a prosperous doctor or lawyer or whatever it may be, was not just a sign of success. It was a sign of virtue. You were doing the right thing by society because you were made of the right stuff.
Once we get the Industrial Revolution, we suddenly have the emergence of a middle class that has more money than they need to survive. How does this new age of material excess change what shopping is for most people?
Well, basically, in the 18th century, you had the birth of the middle class. You had the birth of people who bought pianos that they couldn't play, bought books that they would never read, spent endless amounts of money on big, heavy mahogany tables that were far, far too big for their rooms and stuffed them with furniture. Because by doing so, they were gaining respect in the eyes of others and in the eyes of themselves. Suddenly you had the invention of electricity, the invention of factories and machines. Rather than a cobbler cobbling away at a single pair of shoes for months on end, someone could press a button and 2 dozen pairs of shoes can be pumped out overnight. So suddenly you had a great excess of stuff and a great desire to buy that stuff. Because, you know, social mobility was an enormously attractive thing and owning things was the ticket to it. So the underlying idea is that happiness was not just a thing that could be pursued and caught and achieved and so on. Happiness was a thing that could be bought. Lifelong joy would be yours if you could get a nice house in Hampstead Heath. And this is quite a novel idea in human history where your average caveman wasn't worried about getting a lovely cave. They were sort of worrying about why their pee was turning green or what was that growling noise. And so, yeah, just life became about aspiration and pursuit rather than survival and the accumulation of things. And we convinced ourselves, or were convinced, that our motive for accumulating those things was happiness.
You've got a chapter that's subtitled, Why Capitalism Works Best When You're Sad. Why is that? What do you mean by that?
Well, at bottom, it's quite a simple system, capitalism. It's a system of supply and demand. The more people demand things, the more people want things, the more capitalists have to make and sell those things. And the argument's been made, I'm not the first to make it, that by about the 1920s, 1930s, people pretty much had everything they thought they wanted. They had cars, they had houses, they had heating, they had clothes. Pretty much everything they could think of was available at a competitive price. And so Madison Avenue, the home of capitalism, recruited a big bunch of psychiatrists, chief amongst them a guy who was actually Sigmund Freud's nephew, who made the collective point that the solution to this lack of demand is to create more demand, is to create a sense of incompleteness. Needs and wants must be continually stirred up. If people feel whole and content with their life, if people don't feel there's a problem, they're not going to buy something in order to solve it. And so advertising became about generating a sense of incompleteness. If your life isn't great yet, it's just because you haven't bought the right thing. And so from that moment forth, when advertising sold you a product, it wasn't really selling you that product. It was selling you the promise that you would be happy if you had that product.
Yeah, so, this is when we get to Don Draper in Mad Men, brilliant AMC TV series Mad Men, where Don Draper, as a character, thinks harder about happiness and advertising than just about anyone.
Advertising is based on one thing, happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing, it's okay. You are okay.
How does that sound to you when you hear it?
I'm not entirely sure I subscribe to the last sentence, but I certainly subscribe to the idea that what they are selling is happiness. Like, an ad for beer is really an ad for sort of mateship or masculinity. An ad for perfume is telling you you're going to be sexy and desirable should you buy this. An ad for dish soap is telling you that domestic bliss and happy families will be yours if you just buy this brand. An ad for sneakers is saying this will give you an instant personality. It will make you the rebel. It will make you edgy. It will make you cool. The goal of advertising is to tell us that something we crave, some hole in our heart, will be filled if only we buy this thing.
Don Draper's saying this in a skyscraper in downtown Manhattan, but the series has flashbacks to his harrowing childhood, which was in some absolutely awful farmhouse and whorehouse in the middle of the United States, which is suffering under the Great Depression. I just wonder what kind of a project it was to re-engineer a society's expectations around these sorts of things when people from that era of the Great Depression, which is my grandparents' or your great-grandparents' generation, wouldn't recognize that sentiment at all, that you spend your money on stuff you don't need. It was almost like there was a moral prohibition on that idea going back, 100 years ago in Western society?
I think consumerism is quite a recent phenomenon, quite a sinister one, not just for the environment, but for human psychology.
I was reading recently that one of the problems China is having at the moment is persuading its own citizens to spend more, to spend rather than save a quarter of their income. And I wonder, Chinese people are a lot like what our great-grandparents were like back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, an argument could be made that the reason America is the world's biggest economy is not necessarily because of Yankee ingenuity and hard work, but because Americans will buy anything. Nowhere else in the world could you sell cheese in a can and trans fat in cereal and so on. America is the home of great products, but there's the home of some truly dreadful ones too. But
so many of them have the word happy in the title, like Happy Meals.
Yeah. Every ad that we see on TV is just full of smiling, beautiful people surrounded by admirers who, you know, look like they're on the verge of an orgasm, and just because they're buying a Coke or something. And that's not reality, but some part of us wants to believe that it is, wants to believe that, you know, if we would buy that Coke, we too would be that happy, we too would be that admired, we too would be that attractive.
Modern advertising uses slogans which are instructing people to bypass their rational brains. And I'm thinking of fast food ads where the slogan is, I don't care, I want it, I don't care, I want it. Obey your instinct to eat this, have this, own this.
Because we crave satisfaction, because we've been taught to fear misery, to fear discomfort. As a result, we want to indulge ourselves at all times.
So even though Westerners are much wealthier than 100 years ago, Australians certainly are, there's no tuberculosis anymore, there's no polio, cancer is far more treatable, foreign travel doesn't require you to be deployed to a war. How far does that much peace and prosperity get you in terms of life satisfaction, what the indices tell us about how satisfied people are with their lives, despite all this extra wealth?
Yeah, well, there's been quite a bit of research done by some Harvard people whose names I've forgotten, that money matters a lot until it doesn't. If you don't have enough money to pay the rent or put a roof over your head or have a cupboard full of food or have the occasional treat, a lack of money is going to mean a lack of happiness. But basically, once you get to a certain point, money becomes surprisingly bad at delivering happiness. Basically, it's a curve that plateaus. Money matters until it doesn't. I mean, the average Australian today is wealthier, healthier, safer, more educated than pretty much 99% of all humans that ever lived. The average Australian has a standard of living that Cleopatra or Napoleon would never have dreamed of. We have fridges, we have cars, we have vaccines, we have Netflix, we have sushi, we have air fryers, we have robo-vacuums. And yet, the average Australian looks at an old school friend who's got a three-bedroom house and he's paid off the mortgage, and they feel poor, because the nature of humanity is to normalize the abnormal. The extraordinary will quickly become ordinary.
Is this like the business class paradox? Like if you get bumped up from economy to business class, you go, wow, this is great. This is fantastic. And if you can suddenly afford to fly business class all the time, after all, it doesn't feel that much better than economy.
And you start eyeing off first class. So you get a new job and it's amazing and you're beaming with joy. And then you start to get annoyed by the Zoom meetings or Kevin from accounts and you eye the next rung up the ladder. You get a new house and it feels wonderful, but a year or two passes, you want to renovate the kitchen, the driveway is not quite wide enough, and you start eyeing that other house down the street.
So people who have gotten above that economic baseline, who can pay the rent or the mortgage and pay for food, and they have this excess income and find that the happiness is sort of plateaued or starting to dip, they ask themselves, well, why am I not happier? And that's when they might turn to the self-help section of the local bookshop. What kind of a burden do you think is this religion of self-help pop psychology placing on the shoulders of unhappy people?
It means that good enough no longer feels good enough. When we treat happiness as a default setting When we approach life in the expectation that we ought to be happy, and if we're not, then something is wrong, the result is that we blame ourselves. We feel that we're doing something wrong. We're doing something defective. And also, it's about expectations. I mean, you know, every Christmas, my dad will produce a dusty old bottle of wine from the cellar from somewhere in France and bang on about the silky tannins and the floral notes and hints of gooseberry or something because it costs a few hundred dollars. And you drink it and your expectations rise and you drink it and it's just wine. And you kind of feel, you preload the dopamine and then you have it and it's like, whatever. And whereas, you know, I might go to Aldi and get a $6 bottle of whatever and it's great because I was expecting donkey urine. Equally, you go into a movie that everyone tells you is epoch-making cinema, one of the great artistic triumphs of our time, and you're kind of bored because you're expecting something amazing, whereas you go to a movie that's got 10% on Rotten Tomatoes and it's terrible, but you kind of enjoy it because you're expecting something terrible. I think we have that problem with everything because we've been told that life lived properly should bring us joy. We've been told that work should provide us with a sense of purpose and fulfillment. And instead, it's just work and it's kind of dull. And so therefore, we're dissatisfied with it. We've been told that our partner should be our soulmate, our therapist, our sort of personal sex wizard. And, you know, no human being can possibly fill that role, like in the fairy tale. And after a while, no matter how much you love your partner, you start to get annoyed by how they load the dishwasher or whatever. And wealth, what we were talking about before. We are amongst the richest 1% of people in human history. But I would wager that most of us feel kind of poor and worried about money.
So when people do turn to self-help books, what's the message of these self-help books about why they're not happy?
The message of self-help books is fundamentally that if you're not happy, it's your fault because you didn't sort of manifest hard enough because you haven't bought the right book yet. Your feelings are at the mercy of your thoughts and your actions. If you act the right way, if you read the right books, if you follow the right steps or the right pillars or whatever it may be, the right sorts of feelings result from that.
So much of self-help philosophy seems to be this kind of tough love, but it's kind of bluntly putting it to you that your mindset is the problem.
Yeah.
It's not the world. It's not the generally unhappy nature of human existence, just what it means to live in the world. It's your mindset that's the problem here. So if you're feeling bad and you can't stop feeling bad, then that makes you feel worse, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, there's this whole thing hilariously called meta-unhappiness, which is basically feeling unhappy about the fact that you're unhappy. Because on top of all of these sort of unreasonably high expectations of life and the inevitable failure of your life to meet them, you then feel guilty, you then feel inadequate because you're not living the dream life that this book or society at large has promised you. The flip side of that is that a lot of people are sort of in denial about their periods of misery. They think to themselves, well, I'm doing everything that the self-help book or society at large tells me to do. Objectively, I have every reason to be happy. I've bought those jeans. I have the right job. I have the right partner. I've traveled a lot. My kids are happy. And yet I feel sad. And they don't give themselves permission to deal with that properly because this feeling has no basis in their thoughts or their actions. And so therefore, this feeling to their mind doesn't really exist. But, you know, of course it does. We've built a culture where happiness is considered the default setting and is assumed to be normal. Freud would not have recognized this. His goal was, quote, to replace hysterical misery with, quote, ordinary unhappiness. He absolutely took it as a given that dark moments were a part of life and indeed a precondition to lighter moments. But yeah, in the 100 or so years since Freud, there has, I would say, come to be a blurring of the lines between just ordinary distress and some sort of pathological disorder. But, you know, the fact is sometimes a bad day is just a bad day. Sadness is not always a disease. Worry is not always a malfunction. Stress is not a failure. Feeling down for a week or a month or a year is not necessarily a sign that something is wrong with your life. It can just simply be a sign that you're alive in the first place.
People often say that the world went to hell when David Bowie died in 2016, but I have my own view. I think it was when social media sent everyone running to their tribes. I remember the world before it, and I remember the world after it. And I think increasingly younger people, Gen Z people, are aware of how unhappy and dumb social media is making them. How much responsibility do the social media corporations need to take for this epidemic of modern misery?
Social media really has supercharged this whole happiness culture because it is so performative. The algorithm does not, you know, reward posts photos of you sort of, you know, eating cold noodles at night in vaguely clean underwear. The algorithm doesn't reward photos of you crying in the car park at work. The algorithm wants to see people on yachts. The algorithm wants to hear about promotions. The algorithm wants to see beautiful people carving up the dance floor at a nightclub. And so people curate their life. The expectation out there is that a successful person is a happy person. And so therefore they post pictures of themselves being happy. They insist to the world that they are happy. But yeah, as you say, I like to think that that ship is turning around, and it does seem to be a little less sort of vulgar than it used to be.
So we live in an age where there's so much in the algorithm that's designed to make people feel discontented, unhappy, feeling like they've missed out, feeling like their right to happiness has been abused or ignored or discarded. Your argument is that sadness is not only unavoidable, it's more than that. It's valuable. Why do you say it's valuable?
Well, if I can hit you with that analogy, it's that misery is sort of like the rain. No one likes the rain. It gets your shoes dirty. It gives you mud. It clogs up your gutters. It ruins a picnic. But no one blames themselves for the rain. No one blames their upbringing or their family or their friends or their workplace. No one tries to stop the rain and throw the water back in the sky. No one decides that the existence of rain proves that they're a failure. People just adjust their plans, get an umbrella, and get on with their day.
And yet, Southern California is based on the premise that you can live in permanent sunshine.
Correctly.
And that's the home of Hollywood, right?
Yeah. And so, because we know that the rain is nothing personal, we know it's nothing within our control, and we know that sooner or later it's going to end. But something we also know, Richard, is that as annoying as rain is, without it, life would be a desert. And equally, the same goes for misery. Having these down moments helps us appreciate our up moments. But also, I mean, misery makes you a much more interesting person. I think we've all known someone who's had a smooth and blemish-free life. We've all sat next to a beautiful person who was popular at school and successful in work at a dinner party, and we've all been violently bored. A smooth, bland life produces smooth, bland humans. Perspective, scars, stories, self-knowledge. Misery makes you interesting. Misery builds character. It's sort of a cliche of capitalism that the first generation makes the wealth and the third or fourth squanders it in a haze of drugs and prostitutes. And that's kind of the case. Like, trust fund kids are not stereotypically very hardworking kids. Misery can be the forge that gives iron to your soul.
I think the poster boy for the kind of thing you're talking about here is a figure who I think personally is the largest human being of the 19th century, which was Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States, who led the Union into the Civil War and led the abolishment of slavery. He carried so much sadness. He lost children, beloved children, when they were young, one while he was in the White House. He was living with his wife, who'd been driven half mad by the loss of those children. He knew so much failure in his life. He failed to get elected to the Senate, failed to do this, failed, knew so much failure. But that whole experience seemed to have given him the steadiness, the absolute decency to lead the Union through that crisis, and the steadiness to lead the abolishment of slavery. And all that humor that was in him as well. He seems to be the exemplar of that kind of larger life that's born of the wisdom that comes through the sadness that he'd endured.
Yeah, misery stretches the heart. You recognize pain in others. You judge them less. Misery is like the engine room of empathy and imagination and understanding. A person who's never experienced sickness or embarrassment or poverty or awkwardness is a person who's at risk of narcissism. Caligula and Nero and Uday Hussein, Kim Jong-un, they were all sort of raised as gods.
Donald Trump Jr.
Yeah, exactly. And they become much worse people as a result. And I would also argue they live a much worse life because, you know, it's that narrow lens that I was talking about before. When you've suffered, your world becomes bigger and there's room for more people in it, more conversation in it, more ideas in it, and more empathy in it. The kindest and best people in the world are the ones who have been crushed a few times and then somehow got up again or found a nice place on the ground. It's a wonderful thing. And there is arguments that mild sadness improves your memory, your lie detection, your attention to detail.
Your sense of humour.
Yeah, Proust said grief develops the powers of the mind. And above and beyond that, the tortured artist sort of cliche exists for a reason. Misery makes you creative. Your Virginia Woolf's, your Kafka's, your Plath's, your Van Gogh's. They turn trauma into art. you know, Brian Wilson wasn't having fun and good vibrations. He was dealing with panic and depression and drug addiction. But out of that sort of manure flowered beautiful art. So the opposite of that, I invite you to sort of listen to a lot of pop songs today from 14-year-old millionaires with great haircuts.
I'm one of these tragic men who thinks about the Roman Empire three times a week. And I think about the Vikings all the time. Mm. And this idea, it goes back to your point about the pursuit of happiness is what counts in life and that we have a right to happiness. It's something that would have made the Romans or the Vikings laugh or just shake their heads. I mean, they were about the pursuit of honour. That was the point of life to them. Vikings were obsessed with making their names ring out in a bid for immortality. And the more I thought about that, I thought, you know, in a way, that's kind of similarly pointless. Like Eric the Red, Ragnar Lothbrok, we might remember these Vikings, but they're deader than they ever were. Napoleon is dead. I wonder if there's something about humans that's forever chasing some impossible dream. We'll put something in front of us. We know we can't get to it and keep running at it.
Well, I think the argument could be made that we're the only species that knows we're going to die and that life is a process of coming to terms with that fact. So on some level, we all sort of want immortality. But, I mean, the thought that always came to my mind with that stuff is that it doesn't really matter what you do in this world. You're always going to be forgotten. Elon Musk, Donald Trump, at some point, they will be forgotten. And once you're dead, there's no difference between 5 seconds and 5 million years. You're dead. And so
these are people attending their own funerals.
I think there's something actually hugely liberating about the idea that anything you do is simply not going to matter to anyone else at some point in the future. And it sounds like a grim thought, but I actually think it's quite an empowering one.
And once again, Gen Z, again, might be thinking their way out of this world, and maybe it's the point where they've realised how much damage their phones are doing. They're trying to escape their own phones now, increasingly anyway. There's a thing where Gen Zers are talking about experiencing what they call glimmers, which are small everyday moments of joy or connection. And implicit in that word glimmer is how evanescent, how brief and lovely it is, accepting that it's going to be there momentarily and then fly away.
Yeah, possibly rarely for a middle-aged man. I'm hugely impressed by the younger generation. I think there's a level of emotional intelligence and sophistication there that I didn't have as a kid, and I can guarantee you my parents' generation didn't. They're not experiment this generation because, I mean, I think economically it could well be a disaster because they're just not going to be slaves to the man in the way that our generation was and arguably still is. Anyone I know who employs younger people, the vibe is a bit more they're doing you a favour if they stick at the job. They very much work to live rather than live to work. So I don't know what it means for the future prosperity of the West, but in terms of the future contentment, emotional sophistication, general civility of the West, I think it's a wonderful thing. I constantly talk to, because I'm starting to be a part-time teacher, and I'm constantly talking to kids and just blown away by how well they know themselves and how frequently they have arrived at insights that took my generation until middle age, if they were lucky.
So you're advocating acceptance that life is going to be sad and to see that as normal and just part of life. There are other things too. How about gratitude and curiosity? They're both good for getting you out of your own head and the sense of being mired in unhappiness, aren't they?
I think Einstein once said something along the lines of, you know, there's two ways to live. You can live as if nothing is a miracle, or you can live as if everything is a miracle. I think the latter is the way to go. I think we have to have a sense of wonder. In order to bake a loaf of bread, you first of all have to create the universe. All these things need to be in place for something as seemingly mundane as a loaf of bread to happen. I mean, when I had kids and they were toddlers, one of the great joys was a tram would sort of rattle down the street and my son would say, "Tram, tram." And I was like, "You're right. That is pretty amazing."
Like this giant thing on rails going ding, 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 that's got a whole bunch of people inside of it, is just shooting past us down the street.
Right. It's a remarkable thing. I think having that sort of sense of wonder, having that sense of just how extraordinarily unlikely it is that you are alive. What an extraordinary and random set of circumstances had to happen over billions of years in order to create the thing that is you. You know, they say that some people were born under a lucky star. I would say we were all born under a lucky star because simply to be alive is such an extraordinary thing. I mean, when you have kids, when you're pregnant or your partner's pregnant, you tend to say, oh, well, I don't care if they're a boy or a girl or gay or straight or an accountant or an architect. I just want them to be happy. And actually, that's not true, because when you think about it, it would be theoretically possible to hook your newborn baby up to some sort of dopamine machine, heroin machine. It'd be theoretically possible to have them wriggling in a state of bliss, never walking, never talking, never getting bullied at school, never breaking their arm, never paying a parking ticket, never getting rejected at a nightclub. They could live a life filled with ecstasy and totally a life without any of the things that cause some degree of misery. But obviously, you don't want that for your kid. That's a horror film.
And you're hanging a fair bit on them now that you say that. I just kind of realised the thought's come to me. It's like, I just want them to be happy. It's like, it's your job, kid, to be happy, to make me happy. That's your job now. Yeah. And I'm hanging that on you. That's your responsibility to me now. Correct. As your father.
And so really you don't want that. You want them to have ups and downs and highs and lows. You want them to have a full and rich human experience. You don't want them to just be in a state of unimaginative bliss. The same thing goes for yourself, really.
So having said all that, Eamon, as you leave the studio from this conversation and walk back out to Melbourne, when you get on the tram to go home, will you be going, this is amazing? Or will you go, the bloody tram? Will you go, this tram is great. My son is right. This tram is like it's a miracle of the universe.
I'll do my very best, Richard. And
I want you to tell everyone on the tram that as well. I want you to go, hey, do you know how great this is, this tram?
Well, Richard, I'll probably have a better afternoon than you simply because I had a worse morning. This is just another this is just another show for you. This is just another day in the airways. Whereas for me, I woke up nerve-wracking, harrowing. Where the hell are my notes? What book did I write again? And because I had such an anxious morning, the mere fact that I've gotten through this interview without, accidentally setting fire to the studio and more or less speaking words in the right order, breaking the microphone, simply because I've navigated this hour without disaster, I'm going to have a wonderfully relaxing afternoon. Whereas for you, it's just another day at the office, my friend. Happiness, misery is a precondition for happiness.
Okay, I'm just going to go and bang my head against the wall so that it feels good when I stop.
Correct.
Wonderful speaking with you, Eamon. Thank you very much.
Champion. Thanks, Richard.
Eamon Evans' book is called The Importance of Being Miserable.
Why look so awfully tragic? Put on a happy face. Smiling can work like magic. Put on a happy face. Take off the gloom.
Eamon Evans' book is called The Importance of Being Miserable. Today's conversation with Eamon Evans was made on the lands of the Gadigal and the Wurundjeri peoples. Producer is Maggie Morris. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.